Today we're going to be speaking with Peter Reinhart, baking instructor at Johnson Wales University. He's also the co-founder of the legendary Brother Juniper's Bakery in Sonoma, California. And also he's an author of 5 books on bread baking.
Hello.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
How did you start baking?
Oh, well, it started out as a hobby, and I was living in a Christian community. It was an actual order that was, my headquarters was in Northern California, and I worked on the headquarters staff, and I was a writer and did some theological interviews and things like that. I had an interesting career there, but on the side, I was always cooking, and one of my projects was to look for livelihood opportunities for members of our order, many of whom had culinary but untrained culinary skills, to see if we could convert some of that into a livelihood. And as a result, we our community opened up restaurants around the country and various other sort of food-related projects. And I started working on seeing if I can develop a product line of things, one of which was baked goods. I like baking. And one thing led to another, and before we knew it, my wife, in the community we lived in, we had both married and unmarried members, and my wife, who was the cook at the retreat center of the order, she went to a local cookie store they were going out of business, and they were selling a 20-quart Hobart mixer, and she asked me if I wanted to come with her just to check it out. We were actually engaged at the time. We hadn't gotten married, and while we were there, the owner of the cookie shop convinced us that we should just buy the whole shop and turn it into a restaurant. And we took it back to our community, discussed it, and ended up buying the restaurant and opening it about 4 months later as a showcase for all these various food products that I've been working on the side. The breads took off. We were doing other things, sauces and salad dressings and soups and all sorts of things, but the breads were the things that caught fire. And before we knew it, we had a full-fledged bakery on our hands as well as a restaurant. And we took another space around the corner and opened a bakery. And within 2 years, we were making about 1,000 loaves a day, and pretty soon it was up to 2,000 loaves a day. And little by little, I became an expert on bread. So we came into it through the back door, so to speak.
And the name of the bakery was?
Brother Juniper's Bakery.
Uh-huh.
And it was in Northern California. And as I said, it really started out as part of a ministry outreach. We were doing the restaurant as a chance to try out some food ideas, and the local community was our test market, and they embraced it and got real excited about it. And some of the other products we actually brought out included a barbecue sauce that we called Holy Smoke, and we were looking at going further into some of these food products, but the breads just kind of took over and became such a full-time project that eventually we closed the restaurant and focused on the breads. And about 7 years later, the bakery reached the point where it was bigger than I wanted it to be to manage it. I wasn't really trained in business management, and so we sold it. And I went on to write and teach about breads, and that became sort of the next step in my own evolution.
And is that bakery still running there?
The breads themselves are still being produced amazingly and sold throughout Northern California. It was bought by the people we sold it to, then 7 years later sold it to another company, which was a family bakery business, about a 3-generation bakery business. So they really knew what they were doing, and they had been doing, I would say, private label breads and institutional breads for schools and hospitals. And they were looking for a label, something that a retail bread that they could sell on the shelves. And Brother Juniper's breads by then had a pretty good following. So they bought the product line and are actually doing a very good job of producing it at a high level and wider distribution than we were ever able to get. So it goes on without us.
So it's kind of come in a full circle from like a really homegrown effort to like a commercial.
Right. Yeah. It started out, you know, really I baked some breads for just for fun, and I entered them in the local county harvest fair, and I won a gold medal, and that gave me the confidence to think that I could do it as part of our restaurant. And I had developed one particular bread called Struan, which was based on a traditional Scottish multigrain bread, a harvest bread that's associated with a festival called Michaelmas. And that bread became the flagship bread of our bakery, and in a sense, it's probably my most important contribution to the bread vocabulary of America is this idea of this traditional bread called struan. And after that, it just kept getting bigger and bigger, and we developed a number of other breads. And before we knew it, this hobby had grown into a business.
Why do you think there's such a big explosion in bread baking suddenly in America?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons, and we were just happened to be fortunate to be at the right place at the right time when we were doing our bakery. I had no idea that there was a bread renaissance about to take place, but a number of bakeries had opened around the same time in the San Francisco area, and I think around the country other bakeries as well were starting to appear, introducing some European techniques that American bakers really hadn't been aware of, especially for hearth breads like baguettes and French breads and, you know, the German sourdoughs and things like that. Acme Breads in Berkeley and about three or four other well-known bakeries in San Francisco area were just getting going. The Tassajara Bakery, which was run by a Buddhist center, they were going pretty well. And then all of a sudden Brother Juniper's joined the ranks, and we were all contributing a little bit to this interest. And then the culinary thing happened. Culinary schools were opening all over the country. Americans became real interested in the whole traditional gourmet food style. And I think bread just fit right in with it. A number of Americans had gone to Europe and tasted bread and realized that they could get bread in Europe that they couldn't get in the United States and wondered why. And the bakeries like Acme started putting those good quality breads on the tables of some of the better restaurants like Chez Panisse and, you know, a number of the restaurants in San Francisco. Of course, San Francisco always had a pretty good bread tradition with its sourdough. But these new bakeries, this new generation of young bakers and bakeries pushed it a little bit. They actually started to push the old San Francisco sourdough bakeries because they were introducing even better techniques than the ones that had been holding the fort. And it just spread little by little, and somehow it hit critical mass in the early 90s. Bread Bakers Guild of America formed, and the bakers all started to get together. We brought over some master bakers from Europe to teach us some of their techniques, and then we started entering the Bread Olympics, which is like these culinary competitions, and eventually started to beat the French and the Italians and the Germans at these competitions, and it just grew, and I think it's just the right time for people, you know, who love bread to experience bread at the highest level that it can be made, rather than at the mediocre level, the volume level that we were used to, and it fits right in with the rest of the culinary renaissance that was going on in America.
So you think it's sort of a rejection of bad bagged bread that you get in a supermarket?
Well, it's a cry, I think, for quality over quantity, the willingness to pay a little bit extra for better, for higher quality product, what we might call value-added products. All of this was happening. It was happening with cheese. It was happening with wine and beer. Fortunately, there's a portion of the United States that can afford to pay more, and there will always be the economic realities of, you know, people looking for value and the fact that not everybody can afford to pay for the artisanship that goes into higher quality products. But we saw it in the microbreweries. We see it in this wonderful cheese movement that's happening across the country with farmstead cheeses that are starting to rival the European standards. The media kicked in with some food networks and, you know, all those great cooking shows on PBS over the years. And the demand was there for the first time. And when there's demand, there are people that are willing to go in and, you know, fill that demand with high-quality products.
Do you think that bread is inherent in the American culture?
No, not really. I don't think that the United States yet has a true bread culture the way that the Europeans do. I mean, if you go to France or Germany, you know how important bread is. Greece, for instance, while their breads are not considered the world's greatest breads, on a per capita basis, the citizens of Greece eat more bread than any country in the world. They just can't conceive of eating a meal without bread being a part of it. And that's not the way it is here in the United States, mainly because you know, we haven't needed to have that. We had plenty of other good products and a wonderful agricultural system that could put food on the table. Bread is not always the single most nutritious part of a meal, especially white bread. So when you have access to proteins and good vegetables, you don't always need to fill yourself up with bread. But the Europeans at least have this sense of bread being a central part of the meal and a part of culture. We don't have that, and we're actually just beginning, I think, to tap into that through some of the cafes that are opening up. There's, you know, whether it's a large chain like a Panera or a lot of the individual cafes that are starting to put out wonderful croissants and home-baked breads, artisan breads that are either made there on site or bought from a local bakery. In New York City has 5 or 6 wonderful bakeries that can supply a lot of these places, bakeries like Tomcat and Amy's, that do these breads. Little by little, again, when the quality is there, you can build a culture around it. But I don't think it's anywhere near to the extent that it is in Europe yet. We just don't have that kind of a heritage or tradition.
How does someone go about learning how to bake bread?
It's not really hard, and bread baking, while it is a science, it's not rocket science. It's a pretty basic science, and there's a wonderful large home baking movement alive in the United States. There are web discussion groups through places like the King Arthur Flour website. They have a group called the Baking Circle that share information. There are e-groups like the Bread Baker's List that people can just sort of tap into and continue to get you know, information from other people who are maybe a little bit more experienced. And then in the last 10 years, a number of very, very good books have come out. I've done a few of them, but other people as well. Daniel Leader from the Woodstock area in New York came out with a great book about 10 or 12 years ago called The Bread Alone. There's Nancy Silverton from the La Brea Bakery. La Brea, probably one of the most important bakeries in America because it took an artisan quality bread and found a way to partially bake it, flash freeze it, and then ship it all over the country so that now you don't have to live in a city where there is a great bakery to be able to get really good bread. The supermarkets will take that frozen bread, throw it in the oven, finish it off kind of in the old brown and serve style, but with a much higher quality bread, and you can buy what seems to be a fresh loaf of bread hot out of the oven at your supermarket, and it's just pretty amazing. She's revolutionized the bread world that way, and again, further expanded that interest in high-quality bread. But she also wrote a wonderful book called La Brea Breads, and more and more books come out all the time. Rose Birnbaum wrote The Bread Bible. So you don't have to look far to find a good bread book that can guide you step by step. Some are aimed at beginners, like the Beth Hensberger books, where she takes you, you know, for someone who's never baked bread, to some of the more advanced bread books that require a little more attention to detail. I learned about baking bread from reading Julia Child and followed her 6 pages of detailed instructions on how to make a French baguette. And it was intimidating at first because it was so many steps, but they really weren't that hard to follow. And when I forced myself to follow them, after 1 or 2 times of making the bread, I had this technique in my repertoire, which became the foundation for a lot of the other things that I did. So it starts with a simple loaf. There are whole grain bread books like the Laurel's Kitchen book. I'm working on a new book that's on 100% whole grain bread that will be out in the fall. So there are always good books out there, and that's probably the best way to get started, is just follow a set of instructions from start to finish and just master 1 or 2 breads, and from that foundation, you can pretty much take any other bread formula or bread recipe and make it after that. And what happens is people make a couple loaves of bread. They have that success of a fresh loaf of bread coming out of their oven, of people giving them the feedback that they love it, that they want more of it. You take a loaf to a party, and everybody fusses over you. And before you know it, you're hooked on it as a hobby.
Well, when I first started out kind of testing myself and seeing if I could really produce something good at home. I got Dan Leder's book, and that was a good help. Then I found that when I started reading different people's books or looking on the web, there were so many different, you know, different varieties of ferments, of yeast, or whatever you could use to make bread. You had to kind of sit there and decide which one's the best for me. How do you go about deciding what should I do first, or should I go with sourdough right away?
Right. That's a good question, because there are so many different ways that you can make a loaf of bread, and there's also a lot of misinformation on the web about how you do a sourdough starter and all these sort of myths and urban legends about bread. But I think that what happens, like anything, you need a base foundation. So if you can make a simple loaf of bread, and I would usually start with either a loaf of like sandwich bread or a loaf of French bread, and just make it and sort of get familiar with the flow and the technique and the feel of dough and the, you know, what it means to mix and ferment a piece of clay that has been injected with leaven and it comes to life in front of you and you start to get your hands on it. You can pretty much go to any book after that and sort through the techniques. There are probably the most confusing area is this realm that we call pre-ferments, and these are some of the advanced techniques that the Europeans taught us that these ideas didn't really exist in the early books, like the old Betty Crocker type books that had bread recipes that were just yeast and, you know, you sort of mix it and let it rise and you shape and you bake it. The pre-ferments are a way of using old dough, either, you know, dough with or without salt. Sometimes it's a sponge, sometimes it's stiff. Sometimes it's a piece of wild yeast starter, which we call now sourdough starters. It can be anything that's pre-fermented dough, and you add it to your new dough, and that improves it. It actually kind of quantum ages it so that a dough that comes out of your mixer, you know, that's 1 minute old, has the qualities and the flavor characteristics of a dough that might be 4 or 5 hours old, which translates in the end to a better loaf of bread. These are some of the advanced techniques that the professional bakers and now the home bakers are using. There are various ways of doing it. The interesting thing is after you've made them all the different ways, you find that almost all of them work. So it hardly matters which one you choose. I was just looking at a video that a home baker made on how to make bagels using a sponge technique that the French called the pouliche. Uh-huh. And he had such success with his bagels that he's actually applying this technique to 4 or 5 other kinds of breads, and he's going to do a video for each type. And so, you know, he focused on the pouliche method, which is a French technique. The Italians have something called the biga, which, again, is a piece of pre-fermented dough. It's usually stiffer, kind of like feels like a regular piece of bread dough. Their breads are built around these stiffer pre-ferments. The Germans have methods of both liquid and stiff starters and pre-ferments that they use. Some people use only wild yeast. Some people use a combination of wild yeast and commercial yeast. It's amazing how many different ways there are to make bread. But in the end, it all comes down to one simple thing. It's fermented dough. It's fermented flour that in which flavor is developed. A number of transformations take place in the ingredients that cause what comes out of the oven to be very different than what went into the oven, and in the end you have something that seems to be universally loved by every culture and has taken on almost an iconic position in the food pantheon.
Yeah, and it's like a aesthetic as well as a scientific form of cooking as well.
Well, of course, it's very beautiful. The aromas of bread have long been known to be therapeutic. There's studies that have been done that show that the smell of fresh baked bread can be an antidote to depression. Realtors tell people to bake bread or cookies if you can't do bread. You know, when you're trying to sell a house, because people walk in and smell that have subconscious as well as conscious associations with those aromas. So it works on so many levels. And, of course, it is beautiful. But I think what's most profound about bread is this transformational aspect, the fact that, you know, you start with flour, which is one thing, and you turn that flour into dough, which is really, as I said, living clay. And the clay itself goes through all of these various transformations in its life as a dough. But we don't eat dough. And then it goes through yet one more transformation where we put it in the oven. the yeast essentially sacrifices its life in order to complete its mission, which is to leaven the dough or to raise the dough. And what goes in the oven is dough, but what comes out of the oven is bread. It's almost like the transformation of a caterpillar to a butterfly. And each of these transformations are very distinct, and in the end we have something totally different than what we started out with. And I think that this is one of the reasons why bread works so deeply on people's psyches, is that it has this sort of symbolic value of transformation, of something almost, if not, you know, supernatural, at least something that elevates the idea of nature to another level.
Yeah, one of your books, I notice, is a slow rise metaphor for living.
Yeah, it's the Brother Juniper's bread book, Slow Rise as Method and Metaphor.
Uh-huh.
That was the first book I ever wrote, and that's where I began starting to think about this idea of bread as not only a beloved foodstuff, but also as a symbol, as a sacred symbol. And, you know, we all know that it's a sacred symbol because we read about it in holy books and in our traditions, but not too many people think about why it emerged as that symbol. And so I began to do a little study and just reflection on why bread would have this power and this efficacy. And so that became the basis of my first book. And as a result of that, I've been able to write 6 other books.
Yeah, and it seems like it's an important message, too, today, and the way our lifestyle is so fast-moving and highly technological, where as bread, you know, you have to wait for it. You have to take all the steps to make it the right thing, and it comes out either good or bad.
Yeah, and I didn't know when I came up with that title, Slow Rise as Method and Metaphor, that was before there was this movement, the slow food movement, which I, you know, again, is a wonderful manifestation of this, the same values that you're talking about. And I think that's really what you're getting at, Jeremy, is the idea of bread and food in general as representative of values. And we hunger for that. In a day and age like now, where things are moving so fast and where we read every day in the news about bad decisions, bad judgments, we hunger for values that are nourishing, you know, and make us feel connected to something that's hopeful. And bread has always been that symbol.
Yeah.
Food in general is that symbol, but I think bread stands alone as the one food that historically has always represented that.
Yeah, and I was thinking historically, too, about different things that happened, like the story about the bakers in Vienna making the croissant under the walls of Vienna and kind of as a symbol of the Turks, you know, coming to
uh-huh.
to take over the city.
Right,
and,
right.
And then even in most recent times, the bakers in Iraq being killed because of their religious names or backgrounds and that they're different part of the society, and they were like the ones who were getting knocked off by rival factions. And then, and even about the protests in Mexico about corn, which is like a sacred grain for the Mesoamerican peoples, and how important bread really is. And people don't take time to think about those things.
I know. And of course, you know, some of the news stories are so sad and painful that it's almost hard to bear. But it does certainly showcase and highlight the fact that the bakers, the millers, the people who grow the grain and who cultivate the grain and mill it and prepare it for people, you know, they're important links in our life. And, you know, historically, again, the millers were often the most powerful people in a town because they controlled the grain, which was the bread. And the bakers themselves were very important. You know, we live in a time now where things are so segmented that it's not always like that. But in societies that are perhaps a little bit less technological as ours, you can see again the importance of these people at the center of their own villages or their own cultures.
Yeah, that's interesting. Writing books is a process just like you know, developing a formula for bread. What's the steps in writing a formula? How what kind of variance do you have, or where do you look for guidance to make bread?
One of the best things I think that the American bakers learned when the European master bakers came over here to teach us their techniques was that bakers think in terms of formulas rather than recipes. That is, we think in terms of the relationship of the various ingredients to each other as percentages. So, of course, the flour is the most important ingredient because it represents the largest bulk of the bread. So we call flour the 100% ingredient. And everything else is a ratio against the flour. So a bread formula doesn't add up to 100%. It begins at 100% and it goes beyond that. So typically speaking, salt would usually be around 2% of the total flour weight. Yeast would be anywhere from 1/2 to 2 or sometimes 3% of the total flour weight. The amount of water or liquid in the bread can be anywhere from 55% in something like a bagel to 75 or 80% in a bread like a ciabatta or pugliese, the wet rustic doughs of Italy. And bakers very often, by looking at a formula and seeing the percentages of ingredients, can immediately tell how that bread's going to work, how it's going to taste, how it's going to perform. And they can begin to tweak that formula by changing the percentages before they've even made their first loaf. So most of the breads that I've developed start on paper as an idea based on the percentages and formulas of traditional breads. And then I start to look at what I can do to influence the ingredients, one of which is time and temperature. So if you think of the hard ingredients like the flour, the salt, the yeast, the sugar, and all of that as ingredients, but also factor in time and temperature as ingredients, you realize that the art of creating a bread is all about manipulating time, temperature, and ingredients to create a predictable outcome. And again, some of this is just from practice, and you know, after you've made a few loaves of bread, it all starts to make more sense. But a simple thing like adjusting the time or the temperature by 30 minutes or 10 degrees can make a huge difference in the way that the bread turns out. With my students, I teach at Johnson & Wales University and I teach baking. We give the students all the same formula and work out a recipe for them so that they're all making exactly the same bread, and yet the bread that comes out of the oven is different from each student because of particular choices that they made, how long they kneaded the bread, how firmly they handled it, how much air they squeezed out of it at different stages when they were shaping it, what temperature they used to ferment the dough, so that you can get from the same formula 20 different outcomes with 20 different people if they're not following the exact same temperatures and time frame. So you can see that there's all these variables at work, and then when you're creating a bread, what you do is you try to bring those variables together into a system that will bring about the desired, you know, and a flavorful result. Ultimately, the challenge of a baker is to evoke from the ingredients the full potential of flavor that's trapped in them. And in this case, the main ingredient that we're trying to evoke flavor from is the wheat or the other grains that are in there. And you just can't do that quickly. You have to apply time and certain temperature effects upon those ingredients in order for the flavor that's trapped in them, which is mostly starches and sugars and proteins that are naturally part of the molecular basis of those foods, you need time for those flavors to kind of emerge. And again, this is a big step in the American baking evolution, was the understanding of how time and temperature affect those flavors.
And what is your preferred method of fermentation?
Well, it really varies to the bread. I think you have to look at the bread you're trying to make and determine what's appropriate. For instance, my struan bread that I was talking about earlier, the multigrain bread, if I'm making it with a natural starter, it's going to take a whole different time frame than if I'm making it with commercial yeast. But because that particular bread, being a harvest bread, has so many different ingredients, including honey and a little brown sugar, so that not all of the flavor is coming from the wheat, the time factor isn't as important as it might be in something like French bread, which is just flour, water, salt, and yeast, in which all of the flavor is coming from the flour. And that, though, definitely needs many more hours and will benefit from pre-ferments and will benefit from long, slow fermentations, whereas the multigrain bread might do very well with a two-hour primary fermentation, and then you divide it and shape it into loaves and give it another 90 minutes and bake it. So in about 5 or 6 hours, I can have a wonderful, perfect finished loaf, whereas it might take anywhere from 7 to 12 hours or some overnight processes to get the maximum flavor from a bread that only has white flour in it or whole grain flour in it. So if you're using a sourdough starter, for instance, or what I call a wild yeast starter, that provides some of the time. So a good example would be the famous Poilon breads of France, which are these large 4-pound loaves made with a sifted whole wheat flour that have tremendous amount of complexity and flavor, and yet the only ingredients are flour, water, salt, and yeast. And then the yeast is a wild yeast starter. The percentage of starter is, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40% of the final flour, but it adds so much time and complexity to the finished dough that in about 4 to 6 hours, you can have a loaf that has the complexity of another loaf that might have taken 12 hours.
Yeah, I was there in August, and I always stop by Poilon when I go to Paris because, man, that's some great bread.
Yeah.
But the most fascinating thing was going around Paris and realizing how many bakeries there are. And, like, virtually every corner you'll find one, no matter, you know, if it's a mediocre place or just one of the temples of the boulangerie.
There are hundreds and hundreds of bakeries in the city of Paris, which, you know, is amazing because when you think of a city like, say, New York, which is a large city about the same size or larger, you know, there are probably a few dozen great bakeries, not hundreds and hundreds. But on every street corner, pretty much, you can find a bakery. And in every bakery, there's a baker there who thinks he makes the best baguette in Paris. And it's good that they think it's the best one because they have this sort of friendly rivalry. And they're starting to push each other to see just who is the best. They have competitions every year. For a few years in the 60s and 70s, the quality of French bread really was going downhill as they started to get fascinated with these industrial processes and the ability to make bread for the masses. But just like here in the United States, they've had a renaissance or a revitalization of high-quality bread as well. The next Bread Olympics is going to be in a year. I think it's going to be next April. The American team is just shaping up now, and we're the defending champions, and the French have lost for 3 or 4 times in a row now. They are,
gearing up.
Yeah, they're gearing up. They feel like they need to win this back for their national pride. The competition takes place in Paris, so we've basically gone into their house the last few years. Last time we won, the time before that, the Japanese team beat them, and we came in second.
Wow.
And the time before that, the American team won. So the French are really, they feel like it's time for them to get back on the horse.
Yeah. Well, I met Jeffrey Hamelman a couple times, once here in the city, and then I went up to take a class with him. And I had asked him and Amy Sherber, who I also interviewed, and why isn't rye an important bread in American culture? I mean, German rye breads, I think, are probably the best I've ever had because I was born there and I lived there for a while.
Uh-huh.
And it just hasn't come around yet. Why is that?
Well, you know, you lived there where there is a culture of rye bread. It's a big part of their tradition, and so they have an appreciation for it. And people who grew up perhaps in New York grew up with an appreciation for decent sandwich rye breads because, you know, we've had those for a long time there. But rye is not as pleasing a flavor to Americans as wheat. Wheat is a sweeter grain. It has a higher percentage of gluten. It doesn't require as much expertise to make a great loaf out of wheat as it does out of rye because of the challenges that rye presents. It's got a fair amount of sugars and protein gums. It has a low amount of gluten. So it takes more skill. And so a lot of the art of making a good rye bread was lost in this country. And bakers like Jeffrey Hamelman are bringing it back. He also trained with German bakers and makes fabulous rye breads, and he's taught rye bread classes around the country. And I think we are going to see a resurgence in that kind of bread. Again, it has its own distinct flavor, and part of the learning curve for Americans is to develop an appreciation for these flavors. And it doesn't happen overnight, but it does happen over time. And if the quality is there, then the interest will grow. I'm convinced of that. And, you know, sooner or later, something will happen. Somebody will write an article, or a TV show will come on, or something will happen where it will tip over, like so many other things have tipped over, and all of a sudden rye bread will be the hot bread of the day. Currently, I would say the hot bread of the day is something like ciabatta, which is an amazing bread, and we never really knew about it here until about 10 years ago. And little by little, it got to be so hot that now, you know, Jack in the Box and you know, the fast food chains are making a fairly decent version of it. So now that it's kind of tipped over, it's probably time to discover a new thing. And I think you may be onto something, because you're not the first person who's asked me about rye breads. And when people start asking about it, that's an indication that the interest is there. And it'll probably be only within the next couple of years before rye breads become the hot bread of the day.
And what do you think is the viability of opening like an artisan bakery per se, like a small village bakery like they have in Europe? I mean, you have to really make a lot of bread to make money to keep it open.
You have to make a lot of bread to make bread, and the problem is, again, the economics. It's challenging, especially when you can buy decent bread now at the supermarket, which you couldn't do a few years ago. It would be wonderful if our culture supported more and more small artisan bakeries. I think most towns and cities could support one or two, or, you know, a few, depending on the size of the city. But it's important for people that want to get into this to not be naive and to think that the masses are just waiting to descend upon them to buy their bread. They will come if the quality is there, but you really have to put out a superior product. And what I advise people to do if they're interested in doing a bakery, which is a wonderful thing to do, you just have to know, number one, it's very hard work. It's not the kind of thing that you just sort of buy into and you do it and because you think you can make money. You have to love it. It really is hard work, and you need to have enough passion and love for the process to get you through the hard days and the long nights. I always advise people to join the Bread Bakers Guild of America and to check out their website and become a member, because all the information that we've been talking about, the techniques and methodology, is made available through the guild, both through their printed material and through ongoing classes. In a couple of months, they're going to be holding an event called Camp Bread, which is already sold out. About 300 bakers from around the country will converge in just outside of San Francisco for a three-day baking intensive. It's kind of like fantasy camp for bakers. This is the second time they've done it, and it's fabulous, because each time they have these events, the quality of bread just kind of gets bumped up yet another notch. There's more and more of this happening. So networking through the guild, through some of the websites, you know, and educating yourself is important, and talking to other bakers who are doing it. And then the final step, I think, is to go and visit bakeries that are doing the kind of business that you would like to do, the model of business. For instance, there are bakery cafes. One great model for that would be something like the Pearl Bakery in Portland, Oregon, which I think is a perfect model for a European style and caliber bakery in a city, finding its niche, having a very loyal following, making, you know, decent revenues for the people that work there, and putting out an extraordinary product. There are a few dozen bakeries of that caliber in the United States, and really only a few dozen at this point. And I'd love to be able to say there are a few hundred, and maybe in a couple of years we can say that. But to find bakeries like that, the bakery in Capitola, California, called Gale's Bakery, which is sort of a combination of bakery, a patisserie, and a restaurant, is another model, and there are a few models like that around the country where people are doing food cafe style, as well as wonderful baked goods and breads. That's a model. Then there's the wholesale models like Tomcat, which doesn't have a retail presence, but they make fabulous bread and supply their bread to other outlets and let the outlets use the bread. These are all different ways of doing it, and I think the business person has to find the model that's right for them and then study the successful versions of that are already in existence and try to learn from them the things that that they've learned so that you don't have to learn it the hard way.
Do you think that going really mainstream, bread will become kind of like what organics is today, like one of those billion-dollar kind of businesses that have been taken over by the conglomerates rather than just being a really grassroots effort?
Well, you know, if you look at the La Brea bakery as an example, that was a small bakery in Los Angeles that was very successful in a small sense, and then all of a sudden exploded in a big sense. And a few of the other artisan bakeries like Eche Panis in New York and the Grace Baking Company in California have gone in that direction, trying to do the par-baked frozen bread so that they can retail all across America. So it's already happening that it's a big business. The La Brea Bakery, when Nancy Silverton sold it, she sold it for millions and millions of dollars, it's a multi-million dollar business already. The challenge, of course, is, you know, how do you maintain the quality when you're dealing with quantity? And this is, again, one of the challenges that a local bakery faces is, you know, how can I compete against a national company that's doing, quote, artisan bread and trying to kind of go after the same limited marketplace that I've gone after? The best hope is that the marketplace itself will expand, that the people interested in those products will expand and grow. Local farm markets and places like that have done a great job of expanding the market and the clientele base for high quality goods, and a great way for a local baker or a small bakery to compete against the large bakeries is to have a presence at farm markets. And I know some bakeries that got launched totally on that. They didn't even have a store. They just had an oven somewhere. They baked only for farm markets, and they basically, you know, tailgated at the farm markets and brought the breads and, you know, put down the back of the flap of their truck and sold the breads right off the back of their truck and eventually grew into a very successful business. So there are ways to get out there, but, you know, it starts small and then it does hit critical mass. It's very possible that bread will be big in, you know, for a number of people, but, you know, my hope is that it becomes big while staying small in terms of supporting small artisan, you know, bakers rather than just a few large baking companies.
Well, in the end, too, I think bread will – it'll be the taste of the bread and the quality that'll make the difference in choice, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, quality will win. And I would also say that given also what we're now learning about nutrition and health, organics, of course, is important, and people are finally supporting it. You know, that for, it seems like an overnight success story, but I've been involved in organics for 35 years, and it's taken that long for it to kind of hit critical mass. I think the other thing that's hitting critical mass for in the bread world is whole grains, and I think that anybody who wants to succeed in the next round of breads needs to really understand how to make wonderful, delicious whole grain breads, because that's what people need to eat. We should always have access to good white flour breads, you know, some of the classics and the traditional, you know, beautiful, wonderful breads that are made with white flour. But our diet should probably consist more of whole grain breads than of white flour breads. And so there's an opportunity here for people who can put out fabulous whole grain breads to be able to carve out a niche for themselves before it gets saturated by the large companies.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing work field, the bread industry, and how it's changed so much. I mean, I remember as a kid in the 70s how, you know, health food was like really a strange little market. And my mom, you know, being from France, we couldn't even find a shallot or a leek here when we first moved to America. So
the times have changed. That's
times
sure,
have changed.
Huh? Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a good thing for the consumers, you know, that the quality is there. And now, you know, we just have to make sure that we honor those people who bring those higher quality products to us by supporting them in various, by buying their products, by telling people about them, and by enjoying the things that they make.
You wrote a book about pizzas. And I was just wondering, have you ever been to the Colony Grill in Stamford, Connecticut?
No, I never have.
Because somebody else had written a book about pizzas, and I looked, and I said, they don't have Colony Grill in here. So,
is that your favorite pizza place?
Well, it's one of my favorite pizza places, but it's a great place because I heard a funny story through my brother, who's a a lifelong member of that place. He found it when we first moved to Stamford, Connecticut, and he walked in and asked for a tour of the kitchen, and he noticed that they were rolling out the dough in one of those old kind of washboard...
like a pasta roller sort of?
Yeah, they were plastering the dough through that, and he goes, oh, my God. And so he asked for the recipe because he always wondered, what the hell is in that dough? You know, it's so thin, and it's really delicious. So it's one of my places.
It's interesting. Yeah, well, and I think that although I was not able to get to even a fraction of the great pizzerias in the world, you know, in writing the book, and I've heard about so many more since the book came out, you know, like Colony Grill, that and everyone has their own way of doing it. Each place has their own technique. So there isn't any one method or, you know, a way to do pizza. I think pizza, you know, what makes it the most popular food in the world is that it's basically just dough with something on top of it.
Yeah.
And dough with something on top of it can manifest under, you know, many names, not just pizza, but, I mean, you know, what's a tostada, but a type of pizza? What's a, you know, what's
burrito.
A, yeah, what's a burrito? What's a naan bread with a little garlic butter on it, but an Indian version of pizza? So there's many ways to do pizza. And even, you know, within Italy and the Italian sphere of influence, there's the thick crust and the thin crust, and there's the focaccias and the schiacciatas and the spingiunis, and there's the very thin, almost paper crusts of that we're seeing in some places, and then there's the thick Sicilian-style crust that we see somewhere else. It's all dough with something on it, but in the end, what makes a pizza memorable, and I think what brings people back to their favorite pizzeria or gives them that sort of Hall of Fame status in somebody's memory bank is if the dough itself, if the crust is great, because we don't go back to places just because the topping is great. We go because the crust is great. And that's sort of my first principle of pizza is that to have a memorable pizza, you have to have a memorable crust, whether it's thin, thick, medium, doesn't matter as long as it's memorable. And if you know how to make a memorable crust and you have decent ingredients on top, you're going to have a loyal clientele for as long as you can keep making those pizzas.
Right. What's the process of writing a book?
Well, it's different for everybody, so I can only speak to my own experience, but I would say that the first thing you have to have is an idea, you know, a clear idea of what it is that you're trying to do and how your book is going to add something to the vast amount of literature that's already out there, you know, whether it's a technique, an idea, a flavor, philosophy, it could be anything. And then, of course, beyond that is you have to be as interested in writing as you are in food, or else find a writer to work with you who can take care of the craft of writing. I was a writer before I was a cook, so I love writing about food, but not everybody can do that. Not everybody is a writer. And so you don't have to be to put out a book, but I think you do need an idea. So typically the way a book works is you start with a one or two page proposal or a description, an overview of what the book is about and who the audience is and why the book needs to be written. And then you do like a sample table of contents, which could change while you're writing the book, but you need some kind of a blueprint or an outline to work through. And then a publisher will want to see at least, five or so recipes and a few pages, anywhere from 5 to 10 pages of your writing to see if the book reads well. Because, you know, it may have the best recipes in the world, but if nobody wants to read it, then it's not going to go anywhere. So, that's basically a proposal is not that big. It's an outline, it's an overview, it's a table of contents, and it's a few sample pages and recipes. And that's about all a publisher has time to look at is a few pages. They want to get an idea right away that you know what you're doing, that you've got a great idea, and you can be the one who delivers that idea. You may have the great idea, and they may have no confidence in your ability to actually deliver it. So when you put that together, you want to show in a few pages that you have the ability to fulfill the promise that you're going to make in the overview.
Yeah. I'm actually, you know, since I started my blog, I talked to another blogger, David Leibowitz, and he kind of explained to me that, you know, start writing a blog and see if you can collect some interest. And so I've been doing this, you know, at first I was not really gung-ho about the whole idea, but now that I started meeting people and networking, I said, wow, this is actually a really good way to find out if people are interested in what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, a blog actually is just basically an electronic log, and for many writers started out by keeping a journal. And, you know, a written journal, and now the weblogs have become those journals. It is a great way to find out, number one, if you enjoy writing and if you can write, and it also gives you a chance to practice your writing skills. So, and of course, there are also organizations like the International Association of Culinary Professionals, the IACP, that consists, it's a network of culinarians of all different aspects, from test kitchens to chefs, to restaurateurs, to media people, and many of whom are authors. And they get together once a year. In April, we have a big conference in Chicago this year, but an ongoing sort of resource, a year-round resource for people who would like to do more with their culinary career, such as, you know, going from the kitchen to writing a book. And so I advise people that are interested in doing culinary writing to start with the IACP. There are other organizations beyond that, but start there, because you can network with some really great writers and get to take some workshops and even do telephone conference calls where you can get lots of great ideas on how to get your book published. Uh-huh. So it's IACP.com.
Yeah, I'm a member of them, that organization, and I've yet to even use it to my benefit, so maybe I'll check back into
it. There's a monthly sort of group telephone call where they'll take one subject a month, and, you know, you can call in, I guess it's called a tree line or something like that, and you can actually listen in and participate in a conference with about 50 other people, including, you know, the presenter of that particular topic, who will give you, you know, ideas and field questions. It's kind of like being in a seminar, but doing it from your own phone. So there's so many resources now that didn't exist a few years ago. But again, it always starts with the idea that you have to know what it is you want to do. If you have an idea for a book and you want to know how to take it to the next step, the resources are there, and there are organizations and associations that will help you get there. So, you know, and I hope that that's helpful too.
Well, I know I'm going to send you some information regarding what my ideas are, so maybe you can help me out.
Fantastic, great. And, you know, and if you are able to get to break away and come to the conference in Chicago, I'll be doing a workshop, for instance, on whole grain breads. I'm going to be introducing the new techniques that I've developed for the whole grain breads that will come out in September. For the first time, I'll be showcasing them there at the conference. And, you know, then after that, I'll probably start going around the country and doing them, you know, in cities around the nation when the book comes out.
And when is that coming out?
It's scheduled to be published in September. It's called Whole Grain Breads. I don't know what the subtitle yet is going to be, but, you know, look for a book called Whole Grain Breads by Peter Reinhardt and sometime in the fall. And, you know, after that, hopefully I'll be able to travel around the country and do classes in various cities to demonstrate that the new techniques that are being introduced in the book for how to bring together some of these ideas, you know, these ideas of pre-fermented dough and aging the dough and fermenting the dough properly to bring out the maximum flavor. Again, it all boils down to what I call the baker's mission, which is to evoke the full potential of flavor trapped in the grain. And anybody who can do that can be a popular and beloved baker in their own community, whether it's in their home or in a business.
Yeah, I've got two of your books already, and you know, hopefully going to get out to one of those bread bakers guild.
Oh, that'd be fabulous.
If I could ever get into one of their things, because every time I try to sign up for something, they're sold out. I'm like,
well, if you continue to check in at the website, they're now going to be doing some road shows where they do one-day events in various cities around the country, so something closer to home might be easier for some of the people who can't make it to Camp Bread.
Yeah.
And amazingly, as we've been speaking, I put in a loaf of bread in the oven when we started this conversation.
And it's ready.
And it's ready, yeah. So I'm gonna have to head to the oven and pull out this. I'm trying a 4-pound loaf of bread that has onions and sun-dried tomatoes, and it's the first time I'm making this particular formula. It was one I got out of a book from a well-known baker in Paris named Pougeron.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying his loaf, and hopefully I'll be able to let you know how it turns out.
Well, take a picture for us.
All right, will do.
Thanks a lot.
Jeremy, thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.